Welcome to the Bloom Podcast, Human Stories of Resilience.
And I'd like to begin by acknowledging the traditional custodians of the land on which we're recording today and paying my respects to their elders, past and present. I extend that respect to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples who might be listening. Hey, Steve.
Hey, Susie.
I've been thinking about the really terrible year that was 2020 for me.
And for so many people, yes.
For many people, but I get to trump everybody just about because I also got cancer and went through cancer treatment.
And it's our podcast anyway, so you want to talk about your own suffering, do your own podcast.
I have a question for you as a therapist. That was indisputably a really tough year, and yet I seem to be basically okay in terms of my mental health. It would have, I think, been pretty understandable for anyone in those circumstances to go through some depression, anxiety, something like that. And I don't feel, thankfully, I don't feel that I did. So why is that? Why am I feeling okay? And the next person maybe who also had the bad luck to have a global pandemic and a cancer diagnosis come simultaneously, maybe they're not doing okay and they need a lot more support than me at this point. And it's mental health that I'm talking about, I guess, depression and anxiety.
Well, there's a thorny little question straight off the bat.
I mean, I'm not doing so okay that if anybody wants to bring round like flowers or chocolates, I'd be fine.
But basically, you've come through this terrible time and come out the other side in one piece.
And I feel lucky about that. And I know some of it is that I've got wonderful support from my partner and my family and friends, and I'm financially stable and my workplace was great and all this sort of thing. I mean, there's context, but it's not as simple as that, is it? It's not, okay, you've got things to be happy about, so therefore you are happy, or you're in a bad situation, therefore you are depressed.
It isn't as simple as that. You're absolutely right. And we must be very careful about ever blaming someone. Or I think this happens a lot on the socials, doesn't it? We look at someone's apparently perfect life, and then the next thing that we read is that they've been found dead suddenly at home, you know, in their 20s. And we struggle to put the two together. They appear to have the perfect life. So why aren't they happy? Why aren't they thriving? Which is sort of the converse of your question, which is, and yet other people, yourself included, seem to have such resilience, such depth of strength that they seem to be able to take almost anything, which is just about what's been thrown at you. I've reflected on this myself because I've had a period of depression quite a few years ago now, with a particular set of circumstances around work and then there not being work and things like that. And I think I've recognized about myself that I do have a vulnerability towards it. And I can sometimes feel when I'm getting a little bit closer to it and when I'm feeling further away from it. And I get the impression, well, you tell me, did you feel that you were close to the edge, that you were close to being so deep that your toes couldn't touch the bottom anymore? What did you feel at its worst?
Not really, no. I mean, I had one very bad weekend where I was waiting on some test results that could have gone either way.
Oh, word.
But I have, and thank you for sharing that you went through a time of depression in the past. And I will say that I have as well. So I also feel like I do have a tendency in this direction. And for me, that was when, a number of years ago, I had a series of things happen. My father was very unwell. We moved house. My friend passed away unexpectedly and tragically. And I had a baby who wouldn't bloody sleep. So I was all of those things. And I think that was definitely a low point in terms of my mental health really responded to that in a bad way. So that sort of contextual depression where the environment is bad and your mental health struggles as well, I have also experienced. And then there's other types of, there's also mental health issues where it's not about the context that you're living in, but it's your brain doing weird things to you, right?
And I suppose there's an implied question in there, isn't there? Because while it is no doubt fascinating to think about why it is that some people do and some people don't, and in some circumstances, some people will and some people won't, it leads on to the question, how do we protect ourselves? How do we insulate ourselves? Or how do we respond when it does happen, if it does happen? I suppose in terms of the insulation, the thing is that we know the answers. You know, if Big Pharma came out on the market tomorrow with a pill that was proven to be able to prevent depression by 50 to 75%, people would pay a lot of money for that. And yet we don't necessarily take the steps that would help us to achieve the same results. You know, it's the obvious stuff. It's getting enough sleep. It's doing some exercise. It's trying to eat healthily. It's trying to keep busy. It's the absolute basics. It's staying connected to people.
Do people still say, why can't you just snap out of it? Look at all the things you have to be happy about.
Yeah, the people themselves too often do. And when I do see someone who's going through that, one of the first things I want to do is to reassure them and console them that it's not their fault. It's not something that they are. It's not something that they've done wrong. It is a little bit of a lottery. Because you can take two people apparently with the same kind of background and put them through what seems from the outside to be about the same level of trauma, and they will react in entirely different ways, and they won't know going into it what their reaction is going to be. So when those people then end up saying, but why aren't I happy? I should be happy. That is not only not helping, it's actually making things worse, because then they've got another problem, which is they feel that they are inadequate as well as suffering. But yeah, you're right as well. Of course, there is still, I think we're improving. I think our knowledge about mental well-being is improving. But there is still a tendency for stupid, brainless, moronic people to say, why didn't she just leave? Or why don't they just snap out of it? And it's hard to know if it's even worth having a conversation with those people, because if that's the limit of their understanding, then they need to do some work before they're entitled to have an opinion. End of sermon.
I suppose it with that kind of response, I always think, am I really invested in educating this person, or am I just walking away? The other thing, particularly about mental health struggles, is that when a person is going through them, it's that much harder to address them, because by definition, they impair your decision making and your ability to act. A friend of mine described her depression to me once. What she said was, imagine someone came to you and said, you have to move house tomorrow. And you looked around your house and you thought, well, how would I do that? I've got all this stuff I have to pack. I don't have time to pack. And where am I going anyway? Where do I have to move to? I don't have anywhere to move to it. I just wouldn't know where to begin. And she said that when she was depressed, if someone came to her and said, why don't you get up? Just go and brush your teeth and get dressed. That was what she felt like. She felt like they were proposing a task so monumental, she just didn't even know where to start.
When you meet someone who is really in the grip of that level of depression and sadness, I mean, one image that springs to mind, a fairly obvious one, is that they've got their own little black cloud, which is going around with them and raining down constantly on them. And it makes the whole room dark. It reminds me of, I don't know if you saw Silence of the Lambs, but when Clarice Starling goes in to see Hannibal Lecter in prison, he's behind bars, but he emanates just this horrible black magnetism. And that's a little bit what depression is like up close when you meet someone who's going through it. It feels like such an evil force that if you're not careful, you feel you might tumble down with them.
But there is help. It may not be a pill, a guaranteed pill, but there's medication and there's all the practical things you spoke about. You mentioned the idea of insulating yourself, and I think that's a really good one, because presumably if you wait till you're well deep in the throes of something bad, it's that much harder to get out of it.
It's a little bit like financially. You wouldn't want to be so finely balanced that you just had $1. And so long as everything goes fine, you can get by. But as soon as the car breaks down, or your kids need their teeth fixing, or the roof springs a leak, you've got no resources at all to be able to cover that. And you immediately fall into nothing then adds up anymore. That's a little bit like the way that we want to think about this stuff, that it's when you're well that actually you want to invest in your wellness. And when you're feeling resourceful, that you actually make some attempt to find out what works for you, because there isn't a universal panacea. Different people need different things, and you need to find out what nourishes you and make sure you're getting plenty of it.
And that gives you a bit of a buffer for when things go downhill.
Exactly.
We've got a fantastic guest today. It's Paul. He's a lived experience ambassador for Beyond Blue.
As you know, I'm a little bit allergic to that term, lived experience, but I think I might cut Paul some slack. He does have an amazing story to tell, and it's along the lines that we've just talked about someone who fell into that deep, dark black hole, and about the way that, because it really does have to start with the individual, I think, that until the person is ready to seek help, it's very difficult to help someone who is struggling in that way, that they just need to find somehow just that little sliver of hope that says, I know I need help and I want it, and where it's taken him since.
Today, we're welcoming Paul to the Bloom podcast. Paul, you're involved with the Beyond Blue Lived Experience program.
Yes, that's correct, Susanna.
Welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Tell us a bit about yourself.
I'm 40 years old. I was born in Fiji and grew up in Fiji for the first 15 years of my life and then came across to Australia to finish off my schooling at boarding school. Went to university to study science and then came across to Perth, Western Australia all the way back in 2006, which is where I've been for some years now.
Tell us a little bit about your own experience with mental health issues.
So it all really kicked off for me at the end of the first year of university for me. It was the end of 1999 in Brisbane, where there was quite a significant event, I suppose, which I'd refer to as a psychotic episode. And from that point forward, I fell into some pretty serious mental health struggles of both anxiety and depression. And then as time passed, I came to realize that the condition which I was suffering from was known as social anxiety.
And how did these things affect your life and the path of your journey, I suppose?
So it really, yeah, from that point forward, I could say that my life almost, you know, plunged, sort of free falling into darkness. It was, you know, not a very nice place to be in. And it was maybe unique for me in my personal context that it was quite sudden. Up to that point, I was doing quite well, very sociable character, loved people, loved being around people. A bit of a shy demeanor, but really from that point forward, my life did completely change into, you know, a world of suffering. And I might add, what really triggered that was a heavy habit of smoking marijuana. So it was that which really triggered this psychotic episode and, you know, took me into that period of darkness, I suppose.
And during that psychotic episode, can you remember it, Paul? Do you have memories at all of that time?
Yeah, certainly. Like, I think it'll probably be something that I will never forget. The first experience of that, I was in the company of at least one close friend and the company of a few other people who I weren't so familiar with. And we were smoking marijuana. And my mind just switched to a very paranoid nature. I immediately felt very paranoid that the company that I was in, the people that were there were laughing about me. And I was convinced of this idea. So it was something that I felt was outside of my control. And the fear that I was gripped with was immense.
That was your reality at the time, I guess. It seemed as real to you as this moment is to you now.
Absolutely. I didn't choose to bring it on. And if I had the power within me at the time, I would have liked for it not to have been the case, but I couldn't. It was my absolute reality at the time.
And so you were diagnosed then with social anxiety. Is a psychotic break something that happens? I mean, it sounds like it was all mixed up with both that diagnosis and with the smoking and the place you're in at the time.
I suppose, like, in terms of me arriving at the realization of having this experience of social anxiety, that was something that I made for myself through my own research. It wasn't as if I walked into a GP clinic or a psychologist's clinic and they diagnosed me as such. I came upon that through my own research. And this was after a significant amount of time. It was probably some years before I made that realization. There was the first 2 years from that moment. I can't remember telling not one person about the immense suffering that I was going through.
You were just carrying it on your own.
Yeah, and that certainly didn't help.
Did people know, despite you not telling them?
It's hard to say. Like, I'm sure certainly, yeah, people would have noticed that I would have changed in some manner. I would have been more withdrawn, less willing to participate in social activities. So those outward features, I'm sure people would have noticed. It's so many years ago now. Like, now, as I said, I'm 40 and this would have been back when I was, you know, 18, 19.
What did a day look like for you when you were living this? Were you working? Could you go out and could you go out for dinner, go out for a drink? Or were you really, what would people have seen and what was your experience?
So I might also say that it's changed over time as I've realized that I can do, you know, there was something to do about it to get better. But if I was to be speaking about when the experience hit me at that time when I was 19 and the years that followed from there, I was very withdrawn. So I wouldn't have gone to, you know, nowhere near as many activities as what I would have if I wasn't suffering. But even being social engagements, I would have withdrawn from participation within those social engagements themselves. So I would have kept quiet because I was just so anxious. I was fearful of speaking up and just being myself, really. So just a very withdrawn nature.
And how did you begin to turn it around? Was it the research that you did that began to reveal to you that there was something seriously up that you needed to work on? Was that the beginning for you?
Yeah, so there are probably a couple of key moments. The first moment was, it was about 2 years after it all began. I visited a counselor at university, and this was a free service provided at the university. That was the first time that I'd spoken to somebody about my experience of suffering. That was a huge relief. And then what followed that, and it would have been a couple of years after that, through my research online, I discovered that my condition or the experiences that I was going through was experienced by other people, which was a massive relief to know that what it was that I was going through had a name. And there was a couple of key people. There was one lady, in fact, who lived in Brisbane, who herself had gone through a pretty serious case of social anxiety from much earlier on than me, so through her childhood. And she had overcome it and had dedicated her life essentially to helping other people who were going through that same experience to overcome it as she had. So that was a massive moment for me to know that, one, other people in this world go through the same thing, and critically, two, you don't have to suffer with it for the remainder of your life. You know, there's light at the end of the tunnel and there's solutions there to get better.
And what for you were those solutions?
So a real key component of recovery and treatment and progressing through it to a better place is this evidence-based process called cognitive behavioral therapy. So what that essentially is it's the understanding that these experiences that, talking in my context, the experiences that I was going through, the high anxiety, the depression, the fear, is a result of false beliefs and thoughts that play out in my mind, my perception of the world. And if you change those, my feeling, my experiences of anxiety and depression will reduce to, I guess, a more rational state. But it's not easy work. It takes time and a lot of commitment. But the key thing is that it works.
Are you still working on these things now? Do you think this is a lifelong journey?
Yeah, that's a very good question. Like, it's, I think, again, at the start of the journey, I was, or upon discovering that I could get through it, I had the hopes that I could, I suppose, rid it from my life and not have to experience those immense feelings of anxiety and fear. I certainly have gotten a whole lot better, you know, without doubt. But I do still feel or have experiences of fear and anxiety that I know are irrational and that I know aren't based on the facts of the situation. And so in that sense, I suppose it does still affect me. There is still lingering thought processes that play out related to that anxiety. But I'm still young. Yeah, I continue to sort of rationalize, I guess, situations in my life. I guess the important thing is that over time, I've improved and I've gotten better. I've been able to engage much better with life.
Tell us, Paul, about the work you've been doing with Beyond Blue.
So that's really been a deeply fulfilling aspect, I suppose, to my path through this. One thing that, you know, I realized along the way, as I mentioned before, was how critical and important it was to me to discover other people who had been through my experience and had gotten better. So I felt that there's nothing more that I would love to do but to spread the word to other people out there who may be suffering like I was many years ago and not knowing whether there was any way out. So there was this program that Beyond Blue runs called the Lived Experience Program, which engages people who have lived experience with, you know, mental health challenges, with anxiety and depression, and have gotten better over time. You know, it really resonated with me to be able to have, I guess, a platform to be able to reach out people to let them know that, you know, I've been in a pretty dark place, but I've worked my way through it, and I'm in a much better place now from doing all of that work. Yeah, it's very fulfilling for me to be able to hopefully, you know, get the message out there that it's not something that you need to live with, you know, for the rest of your life. That there's evidence-based solutions there, and I'm, I guess, living evidence of that.
So are you talking to groups of people? Are you talking to one-on-one? How does it work?
Yeah, so how it happens is, I guess, organizations generally reach out to Beyond Blue, and a big purpose of the program, or one of the sort of purposes of the program, is to reduce the stigma that there is out there about talking about mental health and just having the conversation. So you have organizations that engage with Beyond Blue to bring in people like me within the Lived Experience program and speak to them in their workplace about my personal experience. And then that hopefully may resonate with at least one person within that crowd and make it easier to be able to talk about mental health. And I've had a handful of people after those talks that I've given in organizations come to me with their own personal stories. So yeah, it was rewarding for me to know that it had touched one or two people.
Is there one in particular? I mean, obviously you wouldn't reveal any details, but is there one particular example that stayed with you?
Like, there's one that does come to mind, and it was a lady who was speaking on behalf of her child, her son, who was a teenager or maybe a little bit older, and she was quite emotional, and she wanted to know what it was that I could, I guess, you know, provide her with any advice as to how I could assist her child. But obviously I couldn't, but just provide her advice that, you know, she had this person come into a workplace and had spoken about his journey and he had gotten better. And so it was, yeah, I feel, you know, very privileged to be able to hear those sort of intimate stories. And I only hope that by them passing on a story of someone who'd improved and gotten better would make a difference, you know, in this context, her child's situation.
Paul, what a great thing for you to do. I mean, I can hear that what made a difference for you was that mix of professional help and peer support and knowing that you weren't alone and that there was a path to getting better. So what a fantastic thing for you to be giving something back to the community. That's really lovely. Thank you so much for telling us a bit about yourself and your story.
No worries. Thank you very much, Suzanne and Steve.
Thank you, Paul. It's been great. Thank you so much.
No worries.
I like the way that Paul's taken a situation and turned it to his advantage, if you like. Not to his advantage, but he's made use of it. You know, he's someone who obviously went through a very difficult time, and not only has he recovered, but he's now out there preaching, I guess, letting people know that we can talk about this stuff and that it's not a sign of weakness, and importantly, that you can recover. That's great, isn't it?
It must be empowering to find a good thing and be able to share that.
Yeah, because it does something other than just regard what he went through as being an aberration or a fault, and now he's back on track. It's actually turned that into something of its own value. He could not be doing that work that he's talking about now with Beyond Blue had he not had his own experience of troubles.
I was interested in his description of social anxiety as something that really almost crippled him.
It's a terrible thing, the way that he describes it, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's one of those interesting things, social anxiety. We've all been anxious in a social setting, or most of us have. So what's social anxiety in that way?
I suppose one way of thinking about it is that we all have different tolerances for everything. You know, some people like pineapple and other people like beetroot. And this is, I suppose, a similar continuum, but where it matters an awful lot more. You know, the world is constructed for extroverts, isn't it? Job interviews, formative way of being in the world is what the world values, particularly now with social media and all that sort of stuff, where it looks like everyone is living their best life. Please.
I'm definitely living my best life, but only on Instagram.
So for those people who find such things a real trial, who get their energy, get their boost from quiet time and being with themselves and just being settled down, I suppose it's like running flat out all of the time. It's like having a car that is using up more electricity than it is feeding back into the battery. So it's running down the battery just by functioning at all.
And this is not necessarily the people for whom lockdown was a boon, because being introverted doesn't mean you just want to stay home all the time with yourself necessarily. It's about finding your safe space, whatever that is, which might be staying home all the time by yourself, but it might be a small circle or a family circle or a familiar place.
Well, I have had some interesting conversations recently with people in business talking about how a lot of workers have found that Zoom-type meetings are actually much more democratic than the usual in-person ones, because you get to say your piece and people don't get to dominate in quite the same way. I think that's a surprising thing. I hadn't expected that, but I've heard it now enough times to think that people find that they're not wanting to go back into the office, because working from home has its advantages, but that is one of them, that it seems to give more for people who are less out there, if you like.
That's interesting. I would have said Zoom meetings are draining in a different way to real life meetings.
I do know that, because I know in a different context where we've been part of a reading group, we tried Zoom meetings and decided that we didn't want to do that because there were several of us, I wasn't one of them, but several of us who found that being on Zoom all day was really, really draining. And the very last thing you wanted to do was to get back into another Zoom meeting late on in the evening.
Suppose it underlines that everybody has a different way that they enjoy interacting with the world.
Yes. And returning to Paul, it was interesting how listening to his voice, if you listen carefully to his voice when he's talking about doing that stuff, you can hear the change. You can hear something coming into his voice when he's talking about what it means to him to make a difference in other people's lives and to get feedback from other people that they value discovering that these things are not as taboo as they'd thought, and that there's a way of thinking about what you're going through where you can see your way through to the other side.
Yes, I really agree with that. And I hadn't thought of it quite like that. So thank you for pointing that out. His voice comes alive when he's talking about that. It's you can hear the passion and the energy.
That's incredibly engaging. And I always love to hear that, not just when I'm with clients, when I'm with anybody, to see their face when they start talking about something that's really dear to them.
When we started this podcast, Steve, I put my name down as Susie, my alter ego, to give some distance on Susanna, which is what everybody calls me, because
well,
I was...
Well, there's the distance gone now.
Yeah, that's right.
Revealed.
Susie comes out. I wanted some distance, I suppose, between Susanna and Susie. Part of what I've found with podcasting is it makes me nervous, because normally people are not recording my conversation and then listening to it. So normally if I misspeak, if I say the wrong thing, if I don't describe it quite the way I mean, I don't have to be self-conscious about it, because that's just gone. It's dropped into conversation and then it's gone and we move on. And I assume that my dear friends around me forgive me for any stuff ups I've made.
Whereas with a podcast, I suppose there's a sense that it's out there and a hostage to fortune.
Yeah, and this week we had an email pointing out that I'd misspoken in something that I said in last week's episode. Be yourself. What I said was something along the line of, all of our guests so far have been straight. We've got straight guests. We've only had straight guests. And that, of course, was not what I meant to say. What I was trying in my slightly incoherent way to say was, as a podcast, we haven't talked about sexuality. So obviously, I don't know the ins and outs of the sexuality of every guest we've ever had on the show.
You don't know the what? The ins and outs? Is that... Well, if ever anyone needed evidence that this wasn't scripted, now they have it.
Obviously, I don't know the ins and outs of the sexuality of every guest we've ever had on the show. So... that was a silly thing to say.
How have we ended up here where one can innocently misspeak? And I think anybody who knows you would know that you're as tolerant and as inclusive a person as they would know, I would guess. And yet we're so concerned that we may bring down a torrent of something with the merest misspeaking. Having said which, I mean, I think it was disgraceful and you should absolutely be cancelled forthwith. And we'll gloss over the fact that I actually edited the episode and must have heard that little snippet about six times and didn't pick it up and did nothing about it. That's irrelevant.
So, listeners, Steve is looking for a new podcast host. Applications by email only, please. Include a video with your speaking voice.
And the podcast is looking for a new editor with more sensitivity than the current one. Of course, there's a real point here. And the person emailing was absolutely right. It did imply an assumption, which I didn't pick up at all. And we're increasingly questioning these kind of facile assumptions about what's going on in people's lives. And that's good and right and proper, and I applaud that. What I don't applaud is the way that, and I'm not suggesting this is the case with the emailer at all, because that person was made it very clear where they stood on all of that. But you see it every day in social media that someone is accused of all kinds of thought crimes and, you know, misspeaking means that they are something this phobic or that phobic.
Yes, and I'm probably the first to jump on that and say, well, maybe they misspoke, but they're a public figure. They should be more careful.
No, you're not. No, you're not.
I am.
Are you tweeting replies to those things? Are you piling on all the time? And I've just missed it.
No, only in my head.
In your head. Well, that's the difference, isn't it? I mean, of course we can think these things. You can't help what you think. What you can help is what you do about it. I think you should be, not you, one should be writing and then deleting more tweets than one actually presses send on. That's my current view. What are you actually contributing? What actually are you really contributing? Particularly when someone else has already had their opportunity to get up on the plinth and deliver their condemnation. If you're piling on, just stop. Just don't do it. You're not helping. All you're doing is demonstrating that you're virtuous, but maybe not compassionate or empathetic or forgiving or sensible. Or human, or worth hearing.
Have you finished?
I think so.
All right. So lessons for the week. Delete your tweets. Try not to make assumptions about people's sexuality without checking with them first.
And do more of what you love.
And if you're an introvert, stay safe, stay home.